It's Greg Hughes on the 9 to Noon Show on Highland Radio.
Good morning. Welcome back. It is the 9 to Noon Show into hour two for this Thursday, the 15th of June. The weather looks like it's going to break a little bit over the next couple of days. And I was asking around here in studio if people would welcome that. And everyone said no. I would have thought that some people would like a little bit of respite from it now. Is it too soon to even be saying that? Are the nights a little bit too warm? What do you think? Would you be glad to see maybe slightly cooler weather? A little bit of rain even, perhaps? Let us know. 08660 25,000. Right, it's jackpot day today on Bingo, so stay tuned. That's coming up very shortly for you. But I want to get to some comments here now. Rally cars and support vehicles blocked the R254 yesterday as they carried out time trials. It's a regional road in the national park. Tourists hadn't a clue what was going on. Why is this tolerated by Gardaí? Greg, could you find out the sense that it was decided to do roadworks on the mountaintop roundabout at Rally Weekend? I know exactly where you're talking about. I presume you're on about the work that's ongoing at that roundabout and just outside here and all the way down past the petrol station there and out towards Kilmacrennan. I don't know, that roadwork's long overdue. Is there ever a good time to start it? The lads down there and the ladies seem to be cracking through it at the moment. I do understand exactly where you're going from. Presumably, maybe it'll be two lanes of traffic for the weekend, because it is most evenings and over the weekend when they're not working. But I suppose, as I say, just playing devil's advocate here, is there ever a good time? There's always something on, isn't there? Hi, Greg. Good luck and keep safe to Enda McBride in the rally this weekend from all in his cafe. Good morning, Greg. I know it's not related to schools, but last year I was at a Bob Dylan gig and the phone pouch system was used. It made sure that the gig was completely phone-free, which I think benefited everyone. The system was very quick and easy. Yeah, you just put it into the pouch, seal it, and then you unlock it as you get an ad. And sometimes even us as adults perhaps need to be compelled into action. I mean, how many people, you know, spend a fortune and build up all the excitement to go to a concert or a football match, if it's across the channel or wherever it might be, and end up watching it through the screen of a phone? And does anyone ever really look at that footage again? You know, down at the Lewis Capaldi concert, I think, and I've made a couple of videos, but I haven't opened them since. Now, it wasn't much. I mostly watched the concert, but, you know, there were people who had the phone out all the time. Do people really look back at that? It sounds awful because it's so loud, the phone speaker is completely distorted. Or maybe people want to archive it themselves and they do look back at it. I don't know. Good morning, Greg. The idea of phones being locked up during school hours, in my opinion, is a great move. As much as I love young people, their lives are being so taken up and missing out on so much. They are losing the art of conversation and communications, and skills are also being involved in sport and other activities. Then, of course, there is the dreaded bullying that is so common with the phone. So I really hope all schools get involved. Yes, they're losing the art of certain things. We're losing the art of parenting. It's us that puts the phone into their hands. And when I say us, I include myself at younger ages. And it's us that send them off to school with the phone. And don't really probably say, now, don't take your phone out during school. Do we do that? So the schools are going, right, mum and dad and what have you aren't doing this. So we're going to have to bring in these particular pouches. I need to take a back road in the morning rather than getting stuck at the mountaintop for 30 minutes in and around 8:30 a.m. There should be two full lanes from the mountaintop roundabout down to the Optum roundabout. But then where would the traffic go? That gets you to Optum. But then, of course, all that traffic converges further down the line, doesn't it? Hi, Greg. For those that are feeling lonely or want to get involved, I've something new. Ards Walled Garden Community Project at Ards Friary. Every Saturday, it's from 2 to 4. Meet great friends since joining, learned new skills, and I'm out in the fresh air. They're having an open day on Saturday, the 7th of June, 2 to 4. Everyone welcome, music, refreshments, and a plant sale. So that's someone who started recently attending and has found it. They've met people, they're out in the fresh air, learned new skills, which is lovely. Open day on Saturday between 2 and 4 out at Ards Walled Garden. Hi, Greg. There should be a way for people who like the rally but can't go be able to watch the rally live as it happens, like televised. Yeah, it's huge. It would be a huge operation. In fact, even doing a highlights package is prohibitively complicated and expensive, I would say. Listen, I know you want to watch it, but if you want to find out what's happening and get a sense of what's happening and get the results as they happen, please make sure to tune in to Highland Radio over the weekend. Oisín Kelly and his team will be out and about As I say, it doesn't really address your point directly, but you will feel right across all the action. And now with social media too, the teams will be out taking videos as well and sticking them up on our social media. So if you're on Facebook, or if you're not, maybe set up a account, it's more interactive now and more immersive, you know, because we will have videos for you as well as, you know, the usual priority, which is our radio coverage. But in this day and age, you want to offer other service as well. Oisin Kelly will be coming on a little later on to outline exactly what you can look forward to. In relation to that talk about exams, says this emailer, I remember doing my Leaving Junior Cert history exam many years ago, and there were very easy questions like the one Joe Kelly was talking about, but these were usually the first questions in the section and were purposely easy to relax you into the rest of the questions and were not scored high. They just settled you into the paper. And I would say, obviously, Joe picked out a couple of examples, but he's a teacher and he knows an easy paper versus a more complicated one. And he says the history is just, it's been dumbed down and it's not just history. Sure, most of the back roads are 80 kilometres. Is that not the case? Yeah, they are, really, when they're if that's the default lowest, isn't it? But this road at Leck is 60 kilometres. Hi, Greg. The four-lane road into Letterkenny, did you notice it has three lanes marked on the road at the Polestar roundabout going into town? Crash waiting to happen because people in the left lane and middle go in the same way while the left lane should be for only going left, need a sign to say get in lane. I haven't been on that road since it was lined. I don't recall there being three lanes, but if there are, left lane, left turn, centre lane onto the IT or the ATU, right lane out towards the Mount Errigal. So get in lane. There will be signs on the road saying get in lane. So if there are three, I presume that is it. Left lane that way, middle lane straight ahead, right lane right way. Good morning, Greg. The road she goes. The road goes past my house, has a speed limit of 50 kilometres. The councillor done a speed check with the box and the average was 78 kilometres. The high speed recorded was 109. The councillor supposed to be organising ramps, but not sure when. Where's that road? Is it the same? Is it the Leck Road? Probably not, because that speed limit's different. The poor old town bridge was not created for the amount of traffic using it at the minute. Indeed, it's not. And there are some concerns about its structure. The Old Town Bridge is incredibly historic, both in a positive and really negative way. It's an incredibly important, I would have thought, an incredibly important bridge. In fact, it should be, I think, marketed much more for the history that it has and that went on around it. I think when I say we, I'm not from Letterkenny, but I think the people at Letterkenny are missing a trick in not capitalising on that more, because when you go to an area, you know, the shops that you see in Letterkenny, you can see them elsewhere, of course. When you go to an area to visit, it's the history that brings you in, isn't it? Now, Colin Bryce, author of Little Donegal, The Irish in the Gorbals, and Govan Hill joins us on the programme now. Great to have you on the show. Thank you very much indeed, and congratulations on getting your book together, getting it published. It's a great achievement, I think, Colin.
Thanks very much, Craig.
All right, so talk to me about how this this book came about. What was the idea that that you followed up on?
It came out of a couple of things. I moved with my partner, Julie, to Govan Hill. Julie grew up there. We moved there during the pandemic in 2020. And we always had a vague sense that there was always an idea that my grandmother had been born in the Gorbals in, you know, around the turn of the century, but it was very fragmentary. You know, people didn't really know the details of it, and it was all sort of in danger of being lost completely. So we started to do a bit of research about that, and, you know, drew on the family and drew on cousins and my father's memories and all that sort of stuff, and gradually began to piece together the story of my family and their connection to the Gorbals, and then how they came back. They then moved back to Gweedore, but her father tragically died in the middle of all that. Her mother sold the land and had a bit of money, came to Derry. We think she was thinking of going to America, but she saw a bar was for sale in Waterloo Street called the Amish Owen Bar, and she decided to buy it and renamed it the Gweedore Bar. And that was where, like all the bars in Waterloo Street and Derry, you know, the Rosses, the Dunlow, the Gweedore, it was where people walked in from West Donegal, borrowed the money, for the Scotch boat and went across and paid it back whenever they came back in the, you know, after the harvest had been done and stuff like that. So that was our connection. So it was sort of, but that was part of the story. But it was also in starting to do that, you had to sort of try, and I had to try and get my head around a lot of the history of what was happening in Donegal itself. Why were people forced to move away to places like Glasgow and further afield, of course? And what drew them to Glasgow? And it was a bit about sort of understanding the hostility and the antagonism that the Catholic Irish in particular faced whenever they arrived in Scotland, and still do to a certain extent, but you know, much, much less than in those times. But understanding that hostility and how that same hostility is directed towards more recent migrants. You know, Govanhill is one of the most multicultural and diverse, you know, areas of Scotland. It's where all the new arrivals arrive from Eastern Europe, from Africa now, and in Middle East and so on. And also facing those same myths and that same hostility.
Exactly. We'll tease that out. But just that analogy that you made of what we see now, because often what the argument will be is that if you say, well, listen, you know, we left for a better life and what have you, and then people come back to you and say, oh yeah, but we went to work. We went over there, we paid our way, we paid our taxes. It paints this picture that, you know, it was like, all right, here comes the hardworking Irish, all our problems are fixed, our arms are open. But no, it wasn't like that at all. The same sort of, to some extent, too, organised anti-immigrant sentiment that's ongoing at the moment. The Irish felt that even if they went over well-intentioned to work, they felt that as they set foot on the nearby land of Scotland.
Oh, absolutely. Very, very true. I mean, it's shocking when you go back to read the things that were directed towards the Irish. I mean, and all of it contradictory, of course, Greg, as you know. Do you know, on one hand, they're accused of being lazy, and the other hand, they're accused of sort of stealing work from and working for a pittance, from the native Scottish. But it was a very calculated and directed thing towards the Irish. It was that thing. It's the nature of racism. It's to ascribe to a whole section of people, you know, a certain set of characteristics. You know, you're all lazy, or you're all here, you know, you're all God-ridden priests, you know, ridden, you know, sort of, and you're going to undermine our ethos and all that sort of stuff. And very similar things that happen today. And you know, the wonderful thing about Govanhill, I first did the talk that led to this book at the Govanhill International Festival, and that grew out of a great sort of network of anti-racist sort of organizing in Govanhill. Govanhill is a place where a couple of years ago in 2021, we stopped the Home Office deportation van who came to arrest two of our neighbors, people who'd lived in the area for 10 years. And at 6 o'clock one morning, they tried to arrest them. And thousands of people turned out, blocked the streets, and forced the Home Office and the police to release them. And it's that spirit that informs the Govanhill International Festival. And we wanted to do something that celebrated the contribution that the Irish people had made to, like every other community had made to the area. And that's what the book is really trying to do and encourage people to tell their stories of that, you know.
I mean, there are still massive connections between the Northwest particularly and Scotland, and particular areas of Scotland. Do we trace that back? And we'll talk a bit more about why people had to and all that. Do we trace it back to the period where we were seeing large numbers of Irish going to Scotland, or does it predate that?
Well, the relationship between the north of Ireland and Scotland goes way, way back to, like, you know, to prehistory. Do you know what I mean? And also, you know, the Dalriada tribe, you know, sort of from the northeast around Ballycastle, who settled the west of Scotland. They were the Scotty that the Romans described as sort of being hostile to them. You know, sort of and gave their name to Scotland. So that interaction has been going on for a long time. That really became very pronounced in the 1800s, I think, though, and you could see it developing very, very rapidly as agriculture developed. It drew in the need of, you know, sort of agricultural labourers, a lot of seasonal labourers travelling to Scotland for the harvest, and then returning for the winter. That was going on for a lot. In the early 1800s in particular, that was going on a lot. It then really increased when trade began to really pick up between Derry. Like, when the shirt trade started in Derry, its biggest initial market was in Glasgow. And that's why you had the development of a Glasgow boat that started going back and forth, you know, bringing cattle as well as things like manufactured goods and also people. And that was the connection. It was why, you know, there was a particular, that was the route that people from the west of Donegal took to get to Glasgow. It was the easiest, the cheapest way in order to travel and get work. And that is why there was such a high concentration of people, native Gaelic speakers and so on, you know, sort of in places like the Gorbals and Govan Hill, and why they were so tightly organised together.
Sort of painting the picture of someone's life in West Donegal, what was their status and why were they in that position? And, you know, what did going to Glasgow offer them?
Well, you see, it's sort of to trace it back, you know, somebody I quote is a guy called Sivanandan, who was an academic and an anti-racist campaigner in the 50s and 60s in Britain. And as against the hostility that recent migrants from former British colonies were facing in Britain, he said, he coined a phrase, he said, "We are here because you were there." And tracing back that history of why people were in such a poor condition in the west of Donegal, you can't separate that from the influence of British colonialism, the plantation, the forcing of the native Irish onto the worst and most barren and mm-hmm. least productive lands, mm-hmm. So on in the west of the county. Forced them then to go and try to look for work. It's just impossible to sustain a family or sustain life in places like Gweedore, where my people were from. And therefore you had things like the hiring fairs, which hired people out to work in the Lagan Valley, the much better land, you know, so it was cheap labour. You had the movement of people in trying to find work in Derry as Derry began to take off and its industry started to take off. And that was that same thing that was pushing people to go and look for work in seasonal work initially in Scotland, but then also, you know, manufacturing work when they could get it. And so on. Those were the things. So the two things are bound up. You know, there's a reason why people were pushed, you know, sort of to go and move away, and also things that were pulling them to places like Glasgow. And it's the same today. Do you know what I mean? You look at the lives of, you know, sort of my neighbours, you know, who are from Afghanistan and so on, and you know, and from Sudan. You know, you get into a conversation with them, and you know, there's the reasons why they felt they had to leave, and why they felt that they could maybe get a start or get an opportunity. They might have known somebody in Glasgow that they could that they could go and sort of get a start with, and that was the same pattern with the Irish.
What period does this book cover?
Well, it's a kind of sketch, you know. It doesn't by any means claim to be the comprehensive history of the whole.
Yeah, thing. And I think that's laid out there, isn't it? It's not a definitive history, but it's trying to
sketch, you know, sort of the whole history. We're actually working on an update now of a second edition, where we're kind of filling in more of the detail of the 20th century. Do you know what I mean? But it includes. It includes an overview of the history of the Irish in Scotland, but about my family. But it also includes some accounts, oral history accounts from the local Irish history group that has begun to collect interviews with people, just fleshing out what it was actually like growing up being Irish in the Gorbals and Govan Hill. And that's an ongoing thing, and it's something that's really. That's really sort of come alive since we started working on the book, since we published the book. You know, sort of so many people are coming forward to offer their, you know, saying or interviewing their grandparents and, you know, capturing those stories. And that's
it's
a really
so
valuable
important.
Thing,
it really is because, I mean, obviously I'm talking about more recent history, but I would have spoken to people in the past off and on air who did go back, who did work in Scotland, and the reasons for why, and, you know, there was tough upbringings for them, what have you, but sadly some of them have passed away now. And did they write it down? Is there recordings of the... It's really important that, especially in this day and age, I think, where it suits people sometimes to rewrite history.
Exactly.
Or weaponize history or whatever it might be. I think it really is important that we have an accurate view of it.
I agree.
So I think books like this serve a really
it's hard
important
for people
purpose.
Sometimes people aren't encouraged to talk about their own history or, you know, to value it. I think,
well,
you know,
the Irish are ashamed of afraid to speak
that,
out.
You know, I think also
for a fear of upsetting someone or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I think there's also a stoicism as well about people, you know, they don't want to draw attention to the difficulties that they went through in the past or their family went through. You know, they prefer to sort of tell a funny story about the past rather than dwell on things like that. And I think there's a whole lot of those things that I think are very admirable traits in people. And I think, but I do think that there's a really noticeable thing that I find from going around and talking and being stopped by people, you know, now all the time in Glasgow who want to tell their stories, is that I think that there's a real deep pride in Irish people now. Do you know that sense of that having to keep your head down and being ashamed, I think has largely disappeared. And I think, especially in the younger generation, and, you know, we're talking to school kids, we're hoping to do a project in the local Catholic school where lots of the kids there, the local history teachers, and lots of the kids there are the sons and daughters and grandchildren of the Irish immigrants, and who are really fascinated about their history and want to record it and want to go out and interview them and capture those things before it's lost. And that's a very privileged thing to be a part of. You know, it's wonderful to see it coming together, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting hearing, you know, talking about the experience of Irish heading to Glasgow. I mean, it's less than maybe about 20 years ago, maybe a little bit more, that I went to work in London, and the hate against the Irish and the is it racial xenophobic? I don't know, but the abuse was horrible. You know, I worked in pubs and what have you, and it was tough. You know what I mean? I wouldn't like anyone to experience in that. All the usual stereotypes, the words "f off back home," "what are you doing here?" "You're a terrorist." Potato, you know, all the usual stuff. And you know, I think maybe then when I do interviews about some of the language that's being used against, you know, people coming in the other direction, maybe that's why I'm a little bit more, but quite sympathetic to their plight, because on a poxy little scale, I experienced that, and it was horrendous. Yeah, it was so horrendous, it made me sick. Like, it literally made me ill to the point I had to come home.
Yeah. I remember that myself. You know, I remember going to London and feeling the same thing myself. And lots of friends sort of grew up throughout that era. It's interesting. They'd sometimes say it wasn't until bands like the Pogues came along that you could ever say that you were proud to be Irish. Do you know what I mean? The atmosphere generally was very, very hostile, you know, and especially during the Troubles, you know, that was all mixed up in that as well. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, those are difficult times. But as I say, I do think that the generation that's come through all that, you know, still has a quiet pride and is very assured of itself. I think there's very little sense of a deference to Englishness now. Do you know what I mean? I think Irish people in Ireland, and, you know, sort of when they're living in places like Glasgow, you know, have no sense that, you know, sort of they're inferior to the Nigel Farages of the world and those are, you know, backward looking, narrow, you know, inward looking people. Do you know, I think there's a much more generous, outward looking, you know, sort of sense that of the world that Irish people have now.
Yeah,
you know?
it's history repeating itself, as I say, and I'm not all woke and all this. Don't get me wrong, I'm only talking from absolute reality. No, but I'm not coming from. It's just that the way people would instill fear about the Irish in London or whatever is to sort of say, well, they're all terrorists, or they're hiding guns, or they're you know, they're part of a cell or whatever, and that would tarnish an entire population. But it would be a few different people that wanted you out that would be saying that stuff. Now, I'm not saying that was said directly about me. And then what we see is that now the way you sort of try and turn a whole nation against another group of individuals is to suggest that they're all rapists or they're all, you know what I mean? And it just, I hear that, and I kind of was a victim. I'm not a victim, but do you know what I mean? Now, just finally, you point out this is not trying to be and isn't a definitive history, but you talk of it trying to sort of stimulate families to look at their histories, to capture the richness of Irish life. It talk to me a little bit about that in the South Side. What do you hope to come from this beyond the work that you've done?
Well, we're currently compiling an archive. You know, it's online. The organization that has published this book is the Govanhill Baths Community Trust that arose out of an occupation of the baths. They were trying to close local baths. And you know, sort of, which was a community. It was a community centre. It was a laundry. It was all those sorts of things. And in Gubbin Hill, there was an occupation of it, and it's now turned into a wonderful community centre. And so the Gubbin Hill Baths Community Trust is putting together an archive of people and interviewing people wherever we can, and rolling out projects where we're going to go, as I say, go into schools and places like that and record these stories. And I think it's just about, it's about preserving them, and it's about sort of seeing things from that point of view of what it was actually like. It was a very rich life. I mean, it's wonderful to sit with people and hear the stories about how people gathered, the importance of social life. In Glasgow, they would have things called the rakes, where they'd all gather in each other's houses and on a Friday and Saturday night and play music and have a drink and all that sort of stuff. And the kids were all running around. It was, you know, that sense of, you know, sort of a very, people wanting to be sociable, and you know, sort of that was the way that they got through things. So it's about celebrating all of that and all its complexity and all its richness, and saying every migrant community, it does the same thing.
Yeah, and just very finally, have you noticed though any change in Govan Hill? You know, it is stated to be you know, multicultural, strong South Asian communities and what have you, and that presumably at a time, and hope maybe it's still the case, is held up as a beacon of what can be achieved. But obviously things are changing now. People are becoming more nationalist. There's different influences elsewhere. Is that harmony being disrupted?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, occasionally the far right try to make inroads into Govan Hill. This is where, you know, sort of the festival and everything grew out of, you know, sort of the resistance to that. They've never been successful, and it's a real tribute to the community, and you know, sort of there's you know, festivals, celebrations of it all the time, which makes the community very cohesive in spite of the fact that, you know, sort of there are so many different people from different backgrounds there. And I don't get the sense, you know, sort of Nicola Sturgeon is a local MSP. Do you know what I mean? She's wonderful. She launches the anti-racist carnival every year, and very, very proud of the fact of the diversity of the area. And I don't get the sense that nationalism, that Scottish nationalism, certainly has it manifested in places like Govan Hill and the Gorbals, is a narrow nationalism. I think it's actually imbued with that sort of, you know, outward looking thing. I think even though I'm not the biggest fan of the SNP, I'd be more a socialist myself, but at the same time, they very much state that they're against this hostile environment that the Tories are trying to whip up against refugees. They're saying we need immigration, and we know that we need immigration, and we're going to welcome people coming to the country. And I think fair play to them for doing it. And I think that's the atmosphere that you feel in Govan Hill these days.
All right, Colm, author of Little Donegal, The Irish in the Gorbals and Govan Hill. Where can people get your book?
You can get the book either through the Govan Hill Baths website, which just, if you just put in Govan Hill Baths, Little Donegal, you'll find that. And it's also available in Little Acorns Bookshop in Derry. And we're hoping to get it into bookshops further afield in Derry and Donegal over the next couple of weeks as well.
Thank you very much for your time. Have a lovely day. Take care of yourself. That is Colm Bryce there. 086 60 25 000 if you want to have your say. Now, today is World Elder Abuse Awareness Day. It takes place, as I say, today on the 15th of June every year. It was first established by the United Nations in an effort to raise public awareness about elder abuse. Now, Frank Dillon is Head of Communications and Fundraiser with Alone. Good morning, Frank. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning to your listeners. Thanks very much for having me on.
Do I have your title correct?
That's right.
Okay,
that's me.
Excellent. Yep. Right. And I think it's for the first, in the first instance, to recognise that elder abuse comes in many forms, doesn't it?
It does. And unfortunately, it can. It can come in the forms of financial, emotional, physical, sexual, verbal discrimination. And I suppose there's also the abuse of omission or neglect, you know, where people can just be abuse can form by just not doing anything or engaging with somebody.
And instead of us making advances, your charity is highlighting what it describes as a distressing trend of increased safeguarding concerns that have been witnessed over the past year. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, we've seen an increase in the amount of cases that we've come across, and that's it's due to us reaching out to more people, but also it's due to the instances and the reasons behind abuse. And we think there's three main pillars. It's the loneliness, it's the increased incidence of mental health in older people, which was compounded by the COVID pandemic, and the housing situation, where, you know, the lack of suitable housing options for older people, the unfortunate need for younger families to stay in a house with older parents longer, can sometimes unfortunately lead to levels of abuse. And and we need a stronger, the other area is a stronger community, which, you know, we all saw what happened during the pandemic, that, you know, communities got, infrastructure got broken up, and it's about repairing that and having places to go for people, because the more contacts you make, the easier it is to make and report abuse.
Yeah, I mean, and there's an awful lot needs to be done, because it is in so many different areas, and it's going to be across so many different departments, different agencies. We really need a singular, if we don't already have one, Frank, we need a singular task force or ministerial department or something that will bring all of this stuff together. Because when you look through what needs to be done, and the way that the system turns so slowly, operates so slowly in this country, you just wonder, is there, you know, where can we start making positive inroads?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And luckily, look, the HSE have structures in place with safeguarding and protection teams. But with regards legislation, there is an adult safeguarding bill that's sort of stalled in the Senedd. And this was to establish a national adult safeguarding authority, which would require certain people to make reports, and would really underpin the whole area of safeguarding. Now, there is another bill that's coming to, it's on the summer legislative programme, but that just deals with safeguarding around the confines of the Department of Health and the HSE, which is some comfort, and it's to be welcomed. But it is, as you correctly say, it's a broader issue, and it needs a broader piece of legislation to underpin it.
And the safeguarding is a broad church, isn't it? I mean, it might be useful for us to sort of break down what we mean when we say safeguarding.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It can have implications for older people, for disabled people, for anyone in our society who's vulnerable and are not getting the service or getting the protections that they need.
Okay, so more information. Where do people get in touch with a loan, or what do you want to part with, Frank?
Yeah, look, we have a national support and referral line for any older person out there, or anybody who works with older people or knows them. We want to get in touch, and we can cover off service areas. We support over 3,000 people in the Greater Highland Area, CHO1, as it's known. And the way to get in touch with a loan is quite easy. It's 0818-222-024, a national support and referral line. It's open 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Or check us out at alone.ie.
Yeah, and we as a public and as a society have a huge role to play in all of this as well. Thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it. 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and text number, or give us a call on 0749125000. You are tuned to the 9 till noon show, and we have an awful lot to pack in the last hour, so make sure you don't miss that. Okay. Our next guest joins us on the program. Now, you don't need the headphones, Brian, just in case they're in any way distracting for you. Brian McElhenney, spokesperson for the Finn Wheelers Cycling Club. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
Thanks for the invite. No, it's great to have you in. Let me just move that a little bit. Right. Okay, we were chatting to you last year looking for a hard shoulder to be added. It's about 3/4 of a kilometre. It's known as McGrory's Brae in Ballybuffet. As you come out of Ballybuffet, most of you will know that steep incline. And it was a well-organised plan. You know, it had the visuals, it had the getting it out into the media, and perhaps a little bit of success in that regard.
Yeah, well, there's positive news coming our way in regard to that, and some preparation works have actually started. So back in February, there was money allocated for it through the TIA of 1 million So while that was great and all the rest, you know, we always like to see action. So finally we're seeing action, and we're seeing a plan that works are due to commence in October, or sort of in the autumn, that will actually see the hard shoulder works begin on site.
Yeah, so that's, and as far as you're aware, because obviously, you know, is it up the hill or down the hill?
It's both sides, thankfully. So it's just equal risk either way. So like our sort of demand, as it's been called, has been but both ways, because when you're coming from the Donegal town direction, you're having to leave the hard shoulder to go out into the main carriageway. So there's a risk every time you're going from one to the other. So, yep, having seen the plans, they're going to do both sides.
Now, just in terms of, say, for instance, heading in the Donegal town direction, how do we make sure that that hard shoulder doesn't become a de facto climbing lane?
Well, that's the thing. The rules of the road apply for everybody. So, you know, it's not going to be a climbing lane. Obviously, that would be in a much bigger job. So what's been done now is a job that's sort of low cost, easy to provide, and it's a hard shoulder for now. I know that the haulage industry are looking for a climbing lane as well, so maybe that's something that will come eventually. But
this is a big victory for this campaign, and it's a common sense victory as well, because an awful lot of money was spent on the stretch of road from the Donegal Road to the bottom of McGrory's Brae, and then you have two hard shoulders that just stop, and we go to a two lane with, you know, not off run, no nothing, up to the top of the hill, and then, you know, we get hard shoulders again. So this just really is a continuation of hard shoulders. The fact that you had to campaign for this at all really is quite remarkable.
Well, it's a pity we had to do that, but the works carried out in 2016 should have included the hard shoulder right to the top. It's high risk. But thankfully, they're closing that gap now. Mm. And no, we welcome it. It's a positive news story, and I suppose we celebrate that, and we look forward to the actual works carried out.
You'll have to shift that old bike now stuck to the tree.
Well, I think the guys that are cutting the trees may have already done that, but our signs will stay there until the real works begin, because, you know, announcements have been made for so many projects over the years, and
is an easy one, because the space is there on either side of the road. That's good news. All right, so hopefully work in earnest starts in October.
Hopefully, yeah, and hopefully, like, for the main goal here is cyclist safety, and safety for all road users, but we're looking at it from the point of view of cyclists.
I just think that will make it a little bit safer for all road users.
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
No, it's a positive, so we'll celebrate it, yes. And I suppose we'd thank everybody involved, be it the TIA, but also our local councillors, Patrick McGowan and Martin Harley, who were there at our launch and have kept plugging away at making sure it moves forward.
Brilliant stuff. Well done. Okay, we'll watch with interest, because, as you say, we have to stay on top of these things to ensure. I only have 2 minutes because we're flat out today. I want your views, though, on whether or not we should follow Italy's example, stick number plates on bicycles. Would that be something you'd like to see?
No.
Why not?
Wind
resistance?
Well, that's it. Your aerodynamics will be like, how big of a number plate would you require so it's visible? It's a crazy idea, and when Caroline brought it to my attention, I looked at it. It's already been backtracked on. It's impractical. It's been tried in other countries like Canada and Switzerland. Would have had number license plates on bicycles in the past, but that's been abandoned and rejected. It's impractical. It's logistics.
I just wonder when we see more scooters and what have you on the road, because legislation's going through in that regard, and they will need to be identifiable and will be subject to the rules of the road. And they'll be sharing a space, I'd imagine, to a great extent with bicycles. I just wonder if that might kick things on a little bit, whether one likes it or not, because it'll...
Yeah. Now, I think the what was mentioned in Italy is more towards scooters. Like, there has been a sort of big jump in the number of scooters on the road.
Did you see the one on the scooter on the M50?
I've seen all sorts of crazy stuff, you know. But, you know, I know the intentions are for, you know, safety, but it's just sticking a number plate. Like, it's hard enough to get one on a motorbike, so how do you stick one on a narrow bicycle? So it's all been backtracked. It was a crazy idea, and thankfully it's gone no further.
Radio, okay. Okay, we'll finish with a recap of the good news, and as I say, fair play to the Finwheelers Cycling Club. It looks like hard shoulders on either side of the road will be put in place this autumn up the 3/4 kilometre stretch of the the N? What is it? The N? What is that? I don't know.
Forget now.
No, I know it's in my head.
It's in your notes, is it?
No, it's not in my notes. It's in my head. It's the N15.
N15, yeah. It's the number ahead in my head, but I didn't want to put it out there. Sorry.
Get down to Donegal Town. You don't even know the roads.
Oh, we could go in there. But our eyes closed at this stage.
I know. Yeah. But anyway, that McGrory's Bray is most of us know it off. So that's great news. Okay, listen, brilliant stuff. Thanks for calling in with the update, Brian.
Thanks,
Greg. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more after the break.